The Gold Bug. Many years ago, I contracted an intimacy with a Mr. William Legrand. He was of an ancient Huguenot family and had once been wealthy, but a series of misfortunes had reduced him to want. To avoid the mortification consequent upon his disasters, he left New Orleans, the city of his forefathers, and took up his residence at Sullivan's Island near Charleston, South Carolina. Not far from the eastern or more remote end of the island, Legrand had built himself a small hut, which he occupied when I first by mere accident made his acquaintance. His chief amusements were gunning and fishing, or sauntering along the beach and through the myrtles in quest of shells or entomological specimens. In these excursions he was usually accompanied by an old negro called Jupiter, who had been manumitted before the reverses of his family, but who could be induced neither by threats nor by promises to abandon what he considered his right of attendance upon the footsteps of his young Massa Will. It is not improbable that the relatives of Legrand, conceiving him to be somewhat unsettled in intellect, had contrived to instill this obstinacy into Jupiter with a view to the supervision and guardianship of the wanderer. The winters in the latitude of Sullivan's Island are seldom very severe, and in the fall of the year it is a rare event indeed when a fire is considered necessary. About the middle of October 1840 there occurred, however, a day of remarkable chilliness. Just before sunset I scrambled my way through the evergreens to the hut of my friend, whom I had not visited for several weeks, my residence being at that time in Charleston, a distance of 9 miles from the island. While the facilities of passage and repassage were very far behind those of the present day. Upon reaching the hut, I rapped, as was my custom, and getting no reply, sought for the key where I knew it was secreted, unlocked the door, and went in. A fine fire was blazing upon the hearth. It was a novelty, and by no means an ungrateful one. I threw off an overcoat, took an armchair by the crackling logs, and awaited patiently the arrival of my hosts. Soon after dark they arrived, and gave me a most cordial welcome. Jupiter, grinning from ear to ear, bustled about to prepare some marsh hens for supper. Legrand was in one of his fits, how else shall I term them, of enthusiasm. He had found an unknown bivalve forming a new genus, and more than this, he had hunted down and secured, with Jupiter's assistance, a scarabaeus which he believed to be totally new, but in respect to which he wished to have my opinion on the morrow. "And why not tonight?" I asked, rubbing my hands over the blaze, and wishing the whole tribe of scarabaei at the devil. "Ah, if I had only known you were here," said Legrand, "but it's so long since I saw you, and how could I foresee that you would pay me a visit this very night of all others? As I was coming home, I met Lieutenant G. from the fort, and very foolishly I lent him the bug, so it will be impossible for you to see it until the morning. Stay here tonight, and I will send Jupe down for it at sunrise. It is the loveliest thing in creation. You never saw a more brilliant metallic luster than the scales emit. But of this you cannot judge till tomorrow. In the meantime, I can give you some idea of the shape." Saying this, he seated himself at a small table, on which were a pen and ink, but no paper. He looked for some in a drawer, but found none. "Never mind," he said at length, "this will answer." And he drew from his waistcoat pocket a scrap of what I took to be very dirty foolscap, and made upon it a rough drawing with the pen. While he did this, I retained my seat by the fire, for I was still chilly. When the design was complete, he handed it to me without rising. As I received it, a loud growl was heard, succeeded by a scratching at the door. Jupiter opened it, and a large Newfoundland belonging to Legrand rushed in, leapt upon my shoulders, and loaded me with caresses, for I had shown him much attention during previous visits. When his gambols were over, I looked at the paper, and, to speak the truth, found myself not a little puzzled at what my friend had depicted. "Well," I said, after contemplating it for some minutes. This is a strange scarabaeus, I must confess. New to me, never saw anything like it before, unless it was a skull or a death's head, which it more nearly resembles than anything else that has come under my observation. A death's head, echoed Legrand. Oh, yes, well, it has something of that appearance upon paper, no doubt. The two upper black spots look like eyes, huh? And the longer one at the bottom like a mouth, and then the shape of the whole is oval. Perhaps so, said I. But, Legrand, I fear you are no artist. I must wait until I see the beetle itself, if I am to form any idea of its personal appearance. Well, I don't know, said he, a little nettled. I draw tolerably, should do it at least. I've had good masters, and flatter myself that I am not quite a blockhead. But, my dear fellow, you are joking, then, said I. This is a very passable skull. Indeed, I may say that it is a very excellent skull, according to the vulgar notions about such specimens of physiology, and your scarabaeus must be the queerest scarabaeus in the world if it resembles it. But where are the antennae? The antennae, said Legrand, who seemed to be getting unaccountably warm upon the subject. I am sure you must see the antennae. I have made them as distinct as they are in the original insect, and I presume that is sufficient. Well, well, I said, perhaps you have, still I don't see them. And I handed him the paper without additional remark, not wishing to ruffle his temper. But I was much surprised at the turn affairs had taken. His ill humor puzzled me, and as for the drawing of the beetle, there were positively no antennae visible, and the whole did bear a very close resemblance to the ordinary cuts of a death's head. He received the paper very peevishly, and was about to crumple it, apparently to throw it in the fire, when a casual glance at the design seemed suddenly to rivet his attention. In an instant his face grew violently red, in another as excessively pale. For some minutes he continued to scrutinize the drawing minutely where he sat. Then he made an anxious examination of the paper, turning it in all directions. Presently he took from his coat pocket a wallet, placed the paper carefully in it, and deposited both in a writing desk, which he locked. He now grew more composed in his demeanor, but his original air of enthusiasm had quite disappeared. Yet he seemed not so much sulky as abstracted. Seeing my host in this mood, I deemed it proper to take leave. He did not press me to remain, but as I departed, he shook my hand with even more than usual cordiality. It was about a month after this, and during the interval I had seen nothing of Legrand, when I received a visit at Charleston from his man, Jupiter. I had never seen the good old negro look so dispirited, and I feared that some serious disaster had befallen my friend. "Well, Jupe," said I, "what's the matter now? How is your master?" "Well, to speak the truth, master, him not so very well as might be. De bug, I'm very certain that Master Will, he been bit somewhere about the head by that goo bug."
"And what cause have you, Jupiter, for such a supposition? I never did see such a deuced bug. He kick and he bite everything that come near him. Master Will caught him first, but had to let him go again mighty quick, I tell you. Then was the time he must have got the bite. I didn't like the look of the bug mouth myself, nohow, so I wouldn't take hold of him with my finger. But I caught him with a piece of paper that I found. I wrap him up in the paper and stuff a piece of it in his mouth. That was the way."
"And you think then that your master was really bitten by the beetle, and that the bite made him sick?"
"I don't think nothing about it. I knows it. What make him dream about the gold so much, if it ain't cause he bit by the gold bug? I's heard about them gold bugs before this."
"But how do you know he dreams about gold?"
"How I know? Why, cause he talk about it in his sleep. That's how I knows."
"Did you bring any message from Mr. Legrand?"
Jupiter handed me a note which ran thus. "My dear X, since I saw you, I have had great cause for anxiety. I have something to tell you, yet scarcely know how to tell it, or whether I should tell it at all. I have not been quite well for some days past, and poor old Jupe annoys me almost beyond endurance with his well-meant attentions. Would you believe it? He had prepared a huge stick the other day with which to chastise me for giving him the slip and spending the day soulless among the hills on the mainland. I verily believe that my ill looks alone saved me a flogging. If you can in any way make it convenient, come over with Jupiter. Do come. I wish to see you tonight upon business of importance. I assure you that it is of the highest importance. Ever yours, William Legrand. There was something in the tone of this note that gave me great uneasiness. Its whole style differed materially from that of Legrand. What new crotchet possessed his excitable brain? What business of the highest importance could he possibly have to transact? I dreaded lest the continued pressure of misfortune had at length fairly unsettled the reason of my friend. Without a moment's hesitation, therefore, I prepared to accompany the negro. It was almost 3 in the afternoon when we arrived. Legrand had been waiting us in eager expectation. He grasped my hand with a nervous empressement which alarmed me and strengthened the suspicions already entertained. His countenance was pale, even to ghastliness, and his deep-set eyes glared with unnatural lustre. After some inquiries respecting his health, I asked him, not knowing what better to say, if he had yet obtained the scarabaeus from Lieutenant G. "Oh, yes," he replied, colouring violently. "I got it from him the next morning. Nothing should tempt me to part with that scarabaeus. Do you know that Jupiter is quite right about it?" "In what way?" I asked, with a sad foreboding at heart. "In supposing it to be a bug of real gold." He said this with an air of profound seriousness, and I felt inexpressibly shocked. "This bug is to make my fortune," he continued with a triumphant smile, "to reinstate me in my family possessions. Is it any wonder, then, that I prize it? Since fortune has thought fit to bestow it upon me, I have only to use it properly, and I shall arrive at the gold of which it is the index." Hereupon Legrand arose with a grave and stately air and brought me the beetle from a glass case in which it was enclosed. It was a beautiful scarabaeus, and at that time unknown to naturalists, of course a great prize in a scientific point of view. There were 2 round black spots near one extremity of the back and a long one near the other. The scales were exceedingly hard and glossy, with all the appearance of burnished gold. The weight of the insect was very remarkable, and taking all things into consideration, I could hardly blame Jupiter for his opinion respecting it. But what to make of Legrand's concordance with that opinion I could not for the life of me tell. "I sent for you," said he in a grandiloquent tone when I had completed my examination of the beetle. "I sent for you that I might have your counsel and assistance in furthering the views of fate and of the bug." "My dear Legrand," I cried, interrupting him, "you are certainly unwell, and had better use some little precautions. You should go to bed, and I will remain with you a few days until you get over this. You are feverish, and—" "You are mistaken," he interposed. "I am as well as I can expect to be under the excitement which I suffer. If you really wish me well, you will relieve this excitement." "And how is this to be done?" "Very easily. Jupiter and myself are going upon an expedition into the hills, upon the mainland, and in this expedition we shall need the aid of some person in whom we can confide. You are the only one we can trust. Whether we succeed or fail, the excitement which you now perceive in me will be equally allayed." "I am anxious to oblige you in any way," I replied. "But do you mean to say that this infernal beetle has any connection with your expedition into the hills?" "It has. And you will promise me upon your honor that when this freak of yours is over and the bug business, good God, settled to your satisfaction, you will then return home and follow my advice implicitly as that of your physician?" "Yes, I promise. And now let us be off, for we have no time to lose." With a heavy heart I accompanied my friend.
We started about 4 o'clock, Legrand, Jupiter, the dog, and myself. Jupiter had with him a scythe and spades, the whole of which he insisted upon carrying, more through fear, it seemed to me, of trusting either of the implements within the reach of his master than from any excess of industry or complacence. For my own part, I had charge of a couple of dark lanterns, while Legrand contented himself with the scarabaeus, which he carried attached to the end of a bit of whipcord, twirling it to and fro with the air of a conjurer as he went. When I observed this last plain evidence of my friend's aberration of mind, I could scarcely refrain from tears. I thought it best, however, to humor his fancy, at least for the present, or until I could adopt some more energetic measures with a chance of success. We crossed the creek at the head of the island by means of a skiff, and ascending the high grounds on the shore of the mainland, proceeded in a northwesterly direction, through a tract of country excessively wild and desolate, where no trace of a human footstep was to be seen. The sun was just setting when we entered a region infinitely more dreary than any yet seen. It was a species of tableland, near the summit of an almost inaccessible hill, densely wooded from base to pinnacle. The natural platform to which we had clambered was thickly overgrown with brambles, through which we soon discovered that it would have been impossible to force our way but for the scythe, and Jupiter, by direction of his master, proceeded to clear for us a path to the foot of an enormously tall tulip tree, which stood with some 8 or 10 oaks upon the level, and far surpassed them all, and all other trees which I had then ever seen, in the beauty of its form, in the wide spread of its branches, and in the general majesty of its appearance. When we reached this tree, Legrand turned to Jupiter, and asked him if he thought he could climb it. "Yes, massa, you climb any tree he ever see in his life. Then up with you as soon as possible, for it will soon be too dark to see what we are about." "How far must go up, massa?" inquired Jupiter. "Get up the main trunk first, and then I will tell you which way to go. Oh, here, stop. Take this beetle with you." The difficulty of ascension in the present case lay more in semblance than in reality. Jupiter, after one or two narrow escapes from falling, at length wriggled himself into the first great fork, and seemed to consider the whole business as virtually accomplished. The risk of the achievement was, in fact, now over, although the climber was some 60 or 70 feet from the ground. "Which way must go up now, Master Will?" "Keep up the largest branch, the one on this side," said Legrand. Presently his voice was heard in a sort of halloo. "How much further's got to go? Look down the trunk and count the limbs below you on this side. How many limbs have you passed?"
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I done passed 5 big limbs, master, upon this side."
"Then go 1 limb higher." In a few minutes the voice was heard again, announcing that the 7th limb was attained.
"Now, Jupe," cried Legrand, evidently much excited, "I want you to work your way out upon that limb as far as you can. If you see anything strange, let me know."
By this time what little doubt I might have entertained of my poor friend's insanity was put finally at rest. I had no alternative but to conclude him stricken with lunacy, and I became seriously anxious about getting him home. While I was pondering upon what was best to be done, Jupiter's voice was again heard.
"Most out to the end now! Out to the end!"
Here fairly screamed Legrand.
"Do you say you are out to the end of that limb? Soon be to the end, mass. Oh, Lord, God of mercy, what is this here upon the tree?"
"Well," cried Legrand, highly delighted,
"what is it?" "Why, 'tain't nothing but a skull. Somebody been left him head up the tree, and the crows done gobble every bit of the meat off." "A skull, you say? Very well. How is it fastened to the limb? What holds it on?" "Sure enough, massa, must look. Why, this very curious circumstance. Upon my word, there's a great big nail in the skull. What fastens all of it onto the tree? Well now, Jupiter, do exactly as I tell you, do you hear?
Yes, Massa.
Pay attention then. Find the left eye of the skull. I got the left eye now. Hit the left eye. What must I do with it? Let the beetle drop through it as far as the string will reach, but be careful and not let go your hold of the string. All that done, Massa Will. Mighty easy thing for to put the bug through the hole. Look out for him there below.
The scarabaeus hung quite clear of any branches, and if allowed to fall, would have fallen at our feet. Legrand immediately took the scythe and cleared with it a circular space 3 or 4 yards in diameter just beneath the insect, and having accomplished this, ordered Jupiter to let go the string and come down from the tree. Driving a peg with great nicety into the ground at the precise spot where the beetle fell, my friend now produced from his pocket a tape measure. Fastening one end of this at that point of the trunk of the tree which was nearest the peg, he unrolled it till he reached the peg and thence further unrolled it in the direction already established by the 2 points of the tree and the peg for the distance of 50 feet, Jupiter clearing away the brambles with the scythe. At the spot thus attained, a second peg was driven, and about this, as a center, a crude circle about 4 feet in diameter described. Taking now a spade himself and giving another one to Jupiter and one to me, Legrand begged us to set about digging as quickly as possible. I made no doubt that the latter had been infected with some of the innumerable southern superstitions about money buried, and that his fantasy had received confirmation by the finding of the scarabaeus, or perhaps by Jupiter's obstinacy in maintaining it to be a bug of real gold. Upon the whole, I was sadly vexed and puzzled, but at length I concluded to make a virtue of necessity, to dig with a good will, and thus the sooner to convince the visionary by ocular demonstration of the fallacy of the opinions he entertained. We dug very steadily for 2 hours. Little was said, and our chief embarrassment lay in the yelpings of the dog, who took exceeding interest in our proceedings. When the time mentioned had expired, we had reached a depth of 5 feet, and yet no signs of any treasure became manifest. We had excavated the entire circle of 4 feet diameter, and now we slightly enlarged the limit and went to the farther depth of 2 feet. Still nothing appeared. The gold-seeker, whom I sincerely pitied, at length clambered from the pit, with the bitterest disappointment imprinted upon every feature, and proceeded slowly and reluctantly to put on his coat, which he had thrown off at the beginning of his labor. In the meantime I made no remark. Jupiter, at a signal from his master, began to gather up his tools. This done, we turned in profound silence towards home. We had taken perhaps a dozen steps in this direction, when with a loud oath Legrand strode up to Jupiter and seized him by the collar. "You scoundrel," said Legrand, hissing out the syllables from between his clenched teeth. "You infernal black villain! Speak, I tell you. Answer me this instant, without prevarication. Which is your left eye?" "Oh, my golly, Master Will, ain't this here my left eye for certain?" roared the terrified Jupiter, placing his hand upon his right organ of vision, and holding it there with a desperate pertinacity, as if in immediate dread of his master's attempt at a gouge. "I thought so! I knew it! Hurrah!" vociferated Legrand, letting the negro go and executing a series of curvets and caracols, much to the astonishment of his valet, who, arising from his knees, looked mutely from his master to myself, and then from myself to his master. "Come, we must go back," said the latter. "The game's not up yet." And he again led the way to the tulip tree. Here my friend, about whose madness I now saw, or fancied that I saw, certain indications of method, removed the peg which marked the spot where the beetle fell to a spot about 3 inches to the westward of its former position. taking now the tape measure from the nearest point of the trunk to the peg, as before, and continuing the extension in a straight line to the distance of 50 feet, a spot was indicated, removed by several yards from the point at which we had been digging. Around the new position, a circle somewhat larger than in the former instance was now described, and we again set to work with the spade. I was dreadfully weary, but scarcely understanding what had occasioned the change in my thoughts, I felt no longer any great aversion from the labor imposed. I had become most unaccountably interested, nay, even excited. When we had been at work perhaps an hour and a half, we were again interrupted by the violent howlings of the dog. His uneasiness in the first instance had been evidently but the result of a playfulness or caprice, but he now assumed a bitter and serious tone. Upon Jupiter's attempting to muzzle him, he made furious resistance, and leaping into the hole, tore up the mole frantically with his claws. In a few seconds he had uncovered a mass of human bones, forming two complete skeletons, intermingled with several buttons of metal, and what appeared to be the dust of decayed woolen. One or two strokes of a spade upturned the blade of a large Spanish knife, and as we dug farther, three or four loose pieces of gold and silver coin came to light. At sight of these, the joy of Jupiter could scarcely be restrained, but the countenance of his master wore an air of extreme disappointment. He urged us, however, to continue our exertions, and the words were hardly uttered when I stumbled and fell forward, having caught the toe of my boot in a large ring of iron that lay half buried in the loose earth. We now worked in earnest, and never did I pass 10 minutes of more intense excitement. During this interval we had fairly unearthed an oblong chest of wood, which from its perfect preservation and wonderful hardness had plainly been subjected to some mineralizing process, perhaps that of bichloride of mercury. This box was 3 feet and a half long, 3 feet broad, and 2.5 feet deep. We at once saw the impossibility of removing so great a weight. Luckily, the sole fastenings of the lid consisted of 2 sliding bolts. These we drew back, trembling and panting with anxiety. In an instant, a treasure of incalculable value lay gleaming before us. As the rays of the lanterns fell within the pit, there flashed upward a glow and a glare from a confused heap of gold and of jewels that absolutely dazzled our eyes. I shall not pretend to describe the feelings with which I gazed. Amazement was, of course, predominant. Legrand appeared exhausted with excitement and spoke very few words. Jupiter seemed stupefied, thunderstricken. Presently he fell upon his knees in the pit, and burying his naked arms up to the elbows in gold, let them there remain as if enjoying the luxury of a bath. At length, with a deep sigh, he exclaimed, as if in a soliloquy, "And is all come of the gold bug?" It became necessary at last that I should arouse both master and valet to the expediency of removing the treasure. It was growing late, and it behooved us to make exertion that we might get everything housed before daylight. We lightened the box by removing 2/3 of its contents when we were enabled with some trouble to raise it from the hole. The articles taken out were deposited among the brambles. We then hurriedly made for home with the chest, reaching the hut in safety, but after excessive toil, at 1 o'clock in the morning. Armed with 3 stout sacks, which by good luck were upon the premises, we arrived at the pit a little before 4, divided the remainder of the booty as equally as might be among us, and leaving the holes unfilled, again set out for the hut, at which for the second time we deposited our golden burdens, just as the first faint streaks of dawn gleamed from over the treetops in the east. The chest had been full to the brim, and we spent the whole day and the greater part of the next night in a scrutiny of its contents. Having assorted all with care, we found ourselves possessed of an even vaster wealth than we had at first supposed. In coin there was rather more than $450,000, estimating the value of the pieces as accurately as we could by the tables of the period. The value of the jewels we found more difficulty in estimating. There were diamonds, rubies, emeralds, sapphires, and an opal. These stones had all been broken from their settings and thrown loose in the chest. Besides all this, there was a vast quantity of solid gold ornaments. We estimated the entire contents of the chest that night at $1.5 million, and upon the subsequent disposal of the trinkets and jewels, a few being retained for our own use, it was found that we had greatly undervalued the treasure. When at length we had concluded our examination and the intense excitement of the time had in some measure subsided, Legrand, who saw that I was dying with impatience for a solution of this most extraordinary riddle, entered into a full detail of all the circumstances connected with it. "You remember," said he, "the night when I handed you the rough sketch I had made of the Scarabaeus? You recollect also that I became quite vexed at you for insisting that my drawing resembled a death's head. The sneer at my graphic powers irritated me, for I am considered a good artist, and therefore when you handed me the scrap of parchment, I was about to crumple it up and throw it angrily into the fire." "The scrap of paper, you mean," said I. "No, it had much the appearance of paper, and at first I supposed it to be such, but when I came to draw upon it, I discovered it at once to be a piece of very thin parchment. It was quite dirty, you remember. Well, as I was in the very act of crumpling it up, my glance fell upon the sketch at which you had been looking, and you may imagine my astonishment when I perceived, in fact, the figure of a death's head just where, it seemed to me, I had made the drawing of the beetle. For a moment I was too much amazed to think with accuracy. I knew that my design was very different in detail from this, although there was a certain similarity in general outline. Upon turning it over, I saw my own sketch upon the reverse, just as I had made it. My first idea now was mere surprise at the really remarkable similarity of outline, at the singular coincidence involved in the fact that, unknown to me, there should have been a skull upon the other side of the parchment, immediately beneath my figure of the Scarabaeus, and that this skull, not only in outline but in size, should so closely resemble my drawing. But there dawned upon me gradually a conviction which startled me even far more than the coincidence. I began distinctly, positively, to remember that there had been no drawing upon the parchment when I made my sketch of the Scarabaeus. I became perfectly certain of this, for I recollected turning up first one side and then the other in search of the cleanest spot. Had the skull been there then, of course I could not have failed to notice it. When you had gone, and when Jupiter was fast asleep, I betook myself to a more methodical investigation of the affair. In the first place, I considered the manner in which the parchment had come into my possession. The spot where we discovered the Scarabaeus was on the coast of the mainland, about a mile eastward of the island, and but a short distance above high water mark. Upon my taking hold of it, it gave me a sharp bite, which caused me to let it drop. Jupiter, with his accustomed caution before seizing the insect which had flown toward him, looked about for a leaf or something of that nature by which to take hold of it. It was at this moment that his eyes, and mine also, fell upon the scrap of parchment, which I then supposed to be paper. It was lying half buried in the sand, a corner sticking up. Near the spot where we found it, I observed the remnants of the hull of what appeared to have been a ship's longboat. The wreck seemed to have been there for a very great while, for the resemblance to boat timbers could scarcely be traced. Well, Jupiter picked up the parchment, wrapped the beetle in it, and gave it to me. Soon afterward, we turned to go home, and on the way met Lieutenant G. I showed him the insect, and he begged me to let him take it to the fort. Upon my consenting, he thrust it forthwith into his waistcoat pocket, without the parchment in which it had been wrapped, and which I had continued to hold in my hand during his inspection. At the same time, without being conscious of it, I must have deposited the parchment in my own pocket. You remember that when I went to the table for the purpose of making a sketch of the beetle, I found no paper where it was usually kept. I searched my pockets, hoping to find an old letter, when my hand fell upon the parchment. No doubt you will think me fanciful, but I had already established a kind of connection. I had put together two links of a great chain. There was a boat lying upon the seacoast, and not far from the boat was a parchment, not a paper, with a skull depicted upon it. You will, of course, ask, where is the connection? I reply that the skull, or death's head, is the well-known emblem of the pirate. The flag of the death's head is hoisted in all engagements. But, I interposed, you say that the skull was not upon the parchment when you made the drawing of the beetle. How, then, do you trace any connection between the boat and the skull, since this latter, according to your own admission, must have been designed, God only knows how or by whom, at some period subsequent to your sketching the Scarabaeus? Ah, hereupon turns the whole mystery. Although the secret at this point I had comparatively little difficulty in solving, my steps were sure and could afford a single result. I reasoned, for example, thus. When I drew the Scarabaeus, there was no skull apparent upon the parchment. When I had completed the drawing, I gave it to you and observed you narrowly until you returned it. You, therefore, did not design the skull, and no one else was present to do it. Then it was not done by human agency, and nevertheless it was done. At this stage of my reflections, I endeavored to remember, and did remember, with entire distinctness every incident which occurred about the period in question. The weather was chilly, oh rare and happy accident, and a fire was blazing upon the hearth. I was heated with exercise and sat near the table. You, however, had drawn a chair close to the chimney. Just as I placed the parchment in your hand, and as you were in the act of inspecting it, Wolf, the Newfoundland, entered and leapt upon your shoulders. With your left hand you caressed him and kept him off, while your right, holding the parchment, was permitted to fall listlessly between your knees and in close proximity to the fire. At one moment I thought the blaze had caught it and was about to caution you, but before I could speak you had withdrawn it and were engaged in its examination. When I considered all these particulars, I doubted not for a moment that heat had been the agent in bringing to light upon the parchment the skull which I saw designed upon it. You are well aware that chemical preparations exist and have existed time out of mind, by means of which it is possible to write upon either paper or vellum, so that the characters should become visible only when subjected to the action of fire. The color disappears at longer or shorter intervals after the material written upon cools, but again becomes apparent upon the reapplication of heat. I immediately kindled a fire and subjected every portion of the parchment to a glowing heat. At first the only effect was the strengthening of the faint lines in the skull, but upon persevering in the experiment, there became visible at the corner of the slip, diagonally opposite to the spot in which the death's head was delineated, the figure of what I at first supposed to be a goat. A closer scrutiny, however, satisfied me that it was intended for a kid. Well, a kid, then, is pretty much the same thing. Pretty much, but not altogether, said Legrand. You may have heard of one Captain Kidd. I had once looked upon the figure of the animal as a kind of punning or hieroglyphical signature. I say signature because its position upon the vellum suggested this idea. The death's head at the corner diagonally opposite had, in the same manner, the air of a stamp or seal. But I was sorely put out by the absence of all else, of the body to my imagined instrument, of the text for my context. I presume you expected to find a letter between the stamp and the signature? Something of that kind. The fact is, I felt irresistibly impressed with the presentiment of some vast good fortune impending. I can scarcely say why. Perhaps, after all, it was rather a desire than an actual belief. But do you know that Jupiter's silly words about the bug being of solid gold had a remarkable effect upon my fancy? And then the series of accidents and coincidences, these were so very extraordinary. Do you observe how mere an accident it was that these events should have occurred upon the sole day of all the year in which it has been or may be sufficiently cool for fire, and that without fire, or without the intervention of the dog at the precise moment in which he appeared, I should never have become aware of the death's head, and so never the possessor of the treasure? But proceed, I'm all impatience. Well, you have heard, of course, the many stories current, the thousand vague rumors afloat, about money buried somewhere upon the Atlantic coast by Kidd and his associates. That Kidd's accumulations were immense is well known. I took it for granted, therefore, that the earth still held them, and you will scarcely be surprised when I tell you that I felt a hope, nearly amounting to certainty, that the parchment so strangely found involved a lost record of the place of deposit. But how did you proceed? I held the vellum again to the fire, after increasing the heat, but nothing appeared. I now thought it possible that the coating of dirt might have something to do with the failure, so I carefully rinsed the parchment by pouring warm water over it, and having done this, I placed it in a tin pan with the skull downward, and put the pan upon a furnace of lighted charcoal. Upon taking it off, the whole was just as you see it now. Here Legrand, having reheated the parchment, submitted it to my inspection. Characters including many numerals were rudely traced in a red tint between the death's head and the goat. But, said I, returning him the slip, I am as much in the dark as ever. Were all the jewels of Golconda waiting me upon my solution of this enigma, I am quite sure I should be unable to earn them. And yet, said Legrand, the solution is by no means so difficult as you might be led to imagine from the first hasty inspection of the characters. These characters, as anyone might readily guess, form a cipher, that is to say, they convey a meaning. But then, from what is known of Kidd, I could not suppose him capable of constructing any of the more abstruse cryptographs. I made up my mind at once that this was of a simple species, such, however, as would appear to the crude intellect of the sailor absolutely insoluble without the key. And you really solved it. Readily. I have solved others of an abstruseness 10,000 times greater. Circumstances and a certain bias of mind have led me to take interest in such riddles, and it may well be doubted whether human ingenuity can construct an enigma of the kind which human ingenuity may not, by proper application, resolve. In fact, having once established connected and legible characters, I scarcely gave a thought to the mere difficulty of developing their import. The pun upon the word kid is appreciable in no other language than the English. But for this consideration, I should have begun my attempts with the Spanish and French, as the tongues in which a secret of this kind would most naturally have been written by a pirate of the Spanish main. As it was, I assumed the cryptograph to be English. My first step was to ascertain the predominant letters, as well as the least frequent. Counting all, I constructed a table thus. Of the character 8, there are 33. Of the character semicolon, there are 26. Of the character 4, there are 19, and so forth. Now, in English, the letter which most frequently occurs is E. E predominates so remarkably that an individual sentence of any length is rarely seen in which it is not the prevailing character. As our predominant character is 8, we will commence by assuming it as the E of the natural alphabet. Now, of all the words in the language, the is the most usual. Let us see, therefore, whether there are not repetitions of any three characters in the same order of collocation, the last of them being 8. If we discover repetitions of such letters so arranged, they will most probably represent the word the. Upon inspection, we find no less than 7 such arrangements, the characters being semicolon 4, 8. We may, therefore, assume that semicolon represents T, 4 represents H, and 8 represents E, the last being now well confirmed. Thus a great step has been taken. It will be unnecessary to proceed with the details of the solution. I have said enough to convince you that ciphers of this nature are readily soluble, and to give you some insight into the rationale of their development. But be assured that the specimen before us appertains to the very simplest species of cryptograph. It now only remains to give you the full translation of the characters upon the parchment as unriddled. Here it is. A good glass in the bishop's hostel in the devil's seat. 41 degrees and 13 minutes northeast and by north. Main branch, 7th limb, east side. Shoot from the left eye of the death's head a bee line from the tree through the shot 50 feet out. But, said I, the enigma seems still in as bad condition as ever. How is it possible to extort a meaning from all this jargon about devil's seats, death's heads, and bishop's hostels? It left me also in the dark, replied Legrand, for a few days, when one morning it entered into my head quite suddenly that bishop's hostel might have some reference to an old family of the name of Bessop, which time out of mind had held possession of an ancient manor house about 4 miles to the northward of the island. I accordingly went over to the plantation and reinstituted my inquiries among the older negroes of the place. At length, one of the most aged of the women said that she had heard of such a place as Bessop's Castle, and thought that she could guide me to it, but that it was not a castle nor a tavern, but a high rock. The castle consisted of an irregular assemblage of cliffs and rocks, one of the latter being quite remarkable for its height, as well as for its insulated and artificial appearance. I clambered to its apex, and then felt much at a loss as to what should be next done. While I was busied in reflection, my eyes fell upon a narrow ledge in the eastern face of the rock, perhaps a yard below the summit upon which I stood. A niche in the cliff, just above it, gave it a rude resemblance to one of the hollow-backed chairs used by our ancestors. I made no doubt that here was the devil's seat, alluded to in the manuscript, and now I seemed to grasp the full secret of the riddle. The good glass, I knew, could have reference to nothing but a telescope, for the word glass is rarely employed in any other sense by seamen. Now here, I at once saw, was a telescope to be used and a definite point of view, admitting no variation from which to use it. Nor did I hesitate to believe that the phrases 41 degrees and 13 minutes and northeast and by north were intended as directions for the leveling of the glass. Greatly excited by these discoveries, I hurried home, procured a telescope, and returned to the rock. I let myself down to the ledge and found that it was impossible to retain a seat upon it except in one particular position. This fact confirmed my preconceived idea. I proceeded to use the glass. Of course, the 41 degrees could allude to nothing but elevation above the visible horizon, since the horizontal direction was clearly indicated by the words northeast by north. This latter direction I at once established by means of a pocket compass, then pointing the glass as nearly at an angle of 41 degrees of elevation as I could do it by guess, I moved it cautiously up and down until my attention was arrested by a circular rift or opening in the foliage of a large tree that overtopped its fellows in the distance. In the center of this rift I perceived a white spot, but could not at first distinguish what it was. Adjusting the focus of the telescope, I again looked, and now made it out to be a human skull. Upon this discovery I was so sanguine as to consider the enigma solved, for the phrase main branch, 7th limb, east side could refer only to the position of the skull upon the tree, while shoot from the left eye of the death's head admitted also of but one interpretation in regard to a search for buried treasure. I perceived that the design was to drop a bullet from the left eye of the skull, and that a bee line, or in other words, a straight line, drawn from the nearest point of the trunk through the shot, or the spot where the bullet fell, and thence extended to a distance of 50 feet, would indicate a definite point. And beneath this point, I thought it at least possible that a deposit of value lay concealed. Having carefully taken the bearings of the tree, I turned homeward. The instant I left the Devil's Seat, however, the circular rift vanished, nor could I get a glimpse of it afterward, turn as I would. What seems to me the chief ingenuity in this whole business is the fact, for repeated experiment has convinced me it is a fact, that the circular opening in question is visible from no other attainable point of view than that afforded by the narrow ledge upon the face of the rock. In this expedition to the bishop's hostel, I had been attended by Jupiter, who had no doubt observed for some weeks past the abstraction of my demeanor, and took a special care not to leave me alone. But on the next day, getting up very early, I contrived to give him the slip and went into the hills in search of the tree. After much toil, I found it. When I came home at night, my valet proposed to give me a flogging. With the rest of the adventure, I believe you are as well acquainted as myself. I suppose, said I, you missed the spot in the first attempt at digging through Jupiter's stupidity in letting the bug fall through the right instead of through the left eye of the skull. Precisely. This mistake made a difference of about 2.5 inches in the shot, that is to say, in the position of the peg nearest the tree, and had the treasure been beneath the shot, the error would have been of little moment. But the shot, together with the nearest point of the tree, were merely 2 points for the establishment of a line of direction. Of course, the error, however trivial in the beginning, increased as we proceeded with the line, and by the time we had gone 50 feet, threw us quite off the scent. But for my deep-seated impressions that treasure was here somewhere actually buried, we might have had all our labor in vain. But your grandiloquence and your conduct in swinging the beetle, how excessively odd! I was sure you were mad. And why did you insist upon letting fall the bug instead of a bullet from the skull? Why, to be frank, I felt somewhat annoyed by your evident suspicions touching my sanity, and so resolved to punish you quietly in my own way by a little bit of sober mystification. For this reason I swung the beetle, and for this reason I let it fall from the tree. An observation of yours about its great weight suggested the latter idea. Yes, I perceive. And now there is only one point which puzzles me. What are we to make of the skeletons found in the hole? That is a question I am no more able to answer than yourself. There seems, however, only one plausible way of accounting for them, and yet it is dreadful to believe in such atrocity as my suggestion would imply. It is clear that Kidd, if Kidd indeed secreted this treasure, which I doubt not, it is clear that he must have had assistance in the labor. But this labor concluded, he may have thought it expedient to remove all participants in his secret. Perhaps a couple of blows with a mattock were sufficient, while his coadjutors were busy in the pit. Perhaps it required a dozen. Who shall tell?